This is a special episode of Effing Shakespeare, recorded in collaboration with the 2021 AWP Conference and Book Fair. We're thankful to be the official podcast for AWP for a second year and have invited a gallery of guests that you don't want to miss out on. As always, please subscribe, rate, and review so we can continue to bring you interviews of amazing writers sharing about their amazing work. Enjoy.
I'm Jessica Cole.
I'm Fu Lu.
I'm Kate Martin Williams.
And this is Effing Shakespeare. By writers.
For writers.
We're thrilled to talk to Lily Danziger. Her new memoir, Negative Space, which I nearly devoured in one sitting, comes out May 2021 with Santa Fe Writers Project. She's the editor of the essay collection Burn It Down, Women Writing About Anger, and a contributing editor at Catapult. Among other fantastic things with which she's involved, she founded and co-hosts a reading series / newsletter, which you all should subscribe to, called Memoir Monday. We're so happy to have you. Welcome, Lily.
Thank you so much for having me. Glad to be here.
I wanted to get us started today by talking for a second about the progress from your first book, which was a book of 22 essays from women writers who were writing about anger. Did the experience of working on that book and collecting those essays, and obviously spending time thinking about women writing candidly about their experiences with anger, how did it shape and contribute to the ideas that you talk about in Negative Space?
Yeah, well, because publishing is weird and timelines are unpredictable, I was actually pretty much done with Negative Space already when I started working on Burn It Down, even though Burn It Down came out in 2019 and Negative Space is coming out later this year. So I think, you know, maybe if anything, it was kind of the other way around. You know, a lot of the process of writing Negative Space was finding anger that I had that I didn't realize I had, and also finding what was underneath the anger that I didn't know I had. And so, you know, having been through that process myself with the memoir, I kind of was primed to help other writers do that as well in their Burn It Down essays. And a lot of the essays in the anthology ended up being about, you know, other emotions that are hiding underneath anger, and also anger that's hiding underneath other emotions.
Yeah, it's so rarely just the one, right? Especially for women, it doesn't always display that way. Do you mind reading some of Negative Space for us and maybe setting it up a little bit for us?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Let's see, I have this short passage here. This is from early on in the book. I think the only thing we need to know at this point is that Father mailed me a letter right before he died, and it arrived a few days after his death when I was 12 years old. And so, of course, that letter became, you know, a very significant object in my life. And I reference that in this section. They say all the cells in your body regenerate every 7 years. When I turned 20, my father had been dead for 8. So if that theory is true, no cell in my body had ever been on the planet at the same time as him. I'd changed cell by cell into a person he never knew. I was in college, learning new things that I couldn't debate with him or get his opinion on, that I had to decide the value of for myself. I had an apartment in the East Village with a roommate I loved like a sister, whom he'd never met. I was bartending, part of my neighborhood community, not as the daughter of a local artist, but as myself. I had a whole life, and my father wasn't in it. With every step forward, I was acutely aware that I was moving further and further from the version of me that had known him, or even a version of me that he would recognize. I was entering the world as a fatherless woman, after years as a fatherless girl, and I didn't know how to move forward without leaving my father behind. For all of my adolescence, I'd stayed rooted in my grief because that was where I'd felt most connected to him. It was where he had left me, like when I was little and my parents warned that if we ever got separated on the subway, I was to get out at the next stop and wait for them. If I stayed in my grief, my father would know where to find me. But if I just went ahead and enjoyed college and started planning for a career and becoming my own full person in the world, leaving the heaviness of grief behind, I feared then my father would be truly gone, somehow even more than he already was. He The only way to stop that from happening, I thought, was to find a new way to grieve for him. I needed my relationship with my father to change and grow, like every parent-child relationship changes when the child becomes an adult, even if that just meant my relationship with his absence. I realized then that I'd been saving his notebooks, that subconsciously I'd always thought of them as one more letter from him, like the one that arrived days after he died. I'd been keeping this last little bit of him for a future when I would really need it, and I needed it now. A little bit of him that could be new to me, that I could discover with wonder. A way to bring my relationship with him into the present of my life, learning to see him in a new way so that I could mourn him in a new way. That last letter he wrote on the bus was the fatherly advice that I rationed through my adolescence. I stretched it out and applied it to everything, telling myself over and over to stand up and be proud, trying to hear it in his voice. Now I was on another precipice, looking toward adulthood, and I needed a new pearl of wisdom. Just one more letter from him that magically made it across the border of death, and I'd be able to step forward into the rest of my life.
So moving, it's such a good cover. I love the integration of all of your father's art within the book. And I think I love this book for a number of reasons, but one, because it exists as something that can only be a book. Like, you really do have to hold this book in your hands, and the integration of the art with the book was really moving to me, and it almost didn't happen that way, right? Can you talk a little bit about your journey finding the right publisher who was willing to work with the art as well?
Yeah, it was definitely a sticking point, you know, one thing that made it challenging. It was rejected a lot, revised a lot over many, many years. And, you know, and some of the rejections were just because it wasn't right for the publication, because I had submitted it too early, whatever. Some were also definitely because a lot of publishers just didn't know what to do with the artwork. And it is a logistical challenge, you know, and my current publisher and I were, you know, both pulling our hair out, trying to get the layout right, going back and forth a million times, editing the images to make sure they printed well. And, you know, all of this, it adds a whole other layer of difficulty to the already painstaking process of, you know, proofreading and
right.
Book. And so I think, you know, a lot of publishers just didn't want to deal with that, which is understandable, but I was willing to wait. You know, it was never an option for me to take the images out. So it's just a matter of finding somebody who was willing to go through that long, difficult process.
Yeah. And thank God for Santa Fe Writers Project. So cool.
As publishers ourselves, the thinginess of books is still so, the artifact of them, the relic of them even, is still so important to us. And it was amazing to read a book that was like, yes, this needs to be that. And the not ideas, but in things situation.
Yeah. Right. We've talked a lot on the show with other memoirists about, you know, some people call it the sort of therapy, the therapeutic aspect of writing a memoir, and kind of the spectrum of writing this to, as Natalie Goldberg says, you know, write down the bones. So it becomes a process for you as a writer and as a person. But, you know, the other end of that spectrum being a way to connect with readers who may have had similar experiences, or, you know, it's the process of coming from you out into the world instead of just the regenerative process for the individual. So I'm wondering, like, which end of the spectrum you fall on as a person who's written something that's, you know, such a personal narrative, but also, you know, a part of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think I fell pretty much everywhere on that spectrum at various points of the process. I think I had to do a lot of that cathartic mining, how I actually feel about things, putting the emotions down on the page, stuff in order to get to the story that would actually resonate with other people, you know, and then there was a lot of like figuring out how I feel on the page and having to take time away from the book to figure out how I felt before I could write the next section and, you know, all of that stuff. And then in revision is where I pared back everything that was, mm-hmm. you know, just for me and my own processing and not necessarily relevant to a reader.
And some of it was written, am I right, as a part of your graduate thesis?
Undergraduate, yeah.
Undergrad thesis. Yeah, so there was probably some green stuff in there that had to get worked out. I mean, I can't imagine how the drafts changed. Do you recall anything, any one thing that sticks out about what really had to change as you moved forward?
I mean, yeah, everything about it changed. And it took 11 years, which, you know, anybody will change a lot as a person in 11 years, but especially when those 11 years contain all of your 20s. You know, so I was
sure
20 years old when I started this book. I was a completely different person than I am now. And I also, you know, I originally envisioned it as an artist monograph, you know, like a big hardcover coffee table book. Mm-hmm. It was just the story of my father's life and his artwork. And in the first draft, I referred to myself as his daughter, Lily. I was going at it very, you know, fully on the like reportage art historian mode.
Yeah, wow. Mm-hmm.
And thankfully, Wendy Walters, who was my thesis advisor at the New School, was like, what are you doing? You can't do that. this is not working. Put yourself on the page. I'm like, okay. She was the first of many people to tell me, like, to nudge me further in the direction of memoir before it finally became this kind of hybrid thing that it is.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
It's so interesting to hear about that process and to find out that it was all of your 20s, because first of all, I am now a fatherless woman. My dad died 2.5 years ago. And this is actually the first memoir that I've been able to read that included a father's death that I didn't feel like was some sort of sticking pins in myself situation. So thank you for that. But I think there's something so trustworthy about your memoir that I haven't found in others on any subject. And I think it's because you're so honest about the artifice, not only the toil and the changing and the, you know, transformations, but the artifice involved, which calls to mind your father's own art and his mm-hmm. notes on it. When did those connections start being made? Were those connections there from the beginning about your father crafting art and the project that you were embarking on?
That came out later. It wasn't until several iterations into the project that I started to realize that I was kind of doing a version of what he did, you know, and that all of his artwork is autobiographical in a way, even though it's, you know, it's not a direct self-portrait. He uses dogs and rabbits and deer and, you know, all this other imagery, but it all was very personal and very directly reflective of his own life. And I didn't realize until I had already done it that I was kind of also doing that and kind of creating a continuation of some of his work, but shifting the medium of it. So yeah, that kind of that last external layer of the narrative where I'm kind of looking in at the story that I'm telling while I'm telling it mm-hmm. arrived later.
That comes through a lot in the funeral scene and the character of you mm-hmm. it's strange to talk to members sometimes not knowing what to say and realizing that it would be manufactured if you had said something.
Yeah, in a previous draft, that was much more heavy-handed, you know, and I was very directly like, and it wasn't until many years later that I was able to say, you know.
I think this is so powerful, is that I don't feel like you're starting out knowing all the answers, and even though you went through this 11-year process, you could have started at the 11 years and just, you know, put in a little from earlier, but it really feels like we as readers are learning along with you. It's incredibly inviting and just more trustworthy.
Thank you. That's great to hear, because it also made it way more of a pain in the ass to write. <For sure. laughs> Continually revising and adding new layers of what I was figuring out. I'm never going to be done with this thing.
Yes, so, worth it. Trade-off.
So yeah, for anyone who's tuning in to find out that it's really easy and you can skip all the hard part, that's a different show.
Like what?
I love this scene. We keep saying scene, but I love the moment in the book where you write about the weekend workshop you took with
Lydia Yukimich.
Yes, Lydia Yukimich. Yeah, that we writers have central metaphors. And I wonder if you could talk about it and maybe tell anybody who's listening about that sort of realization about your father's central metaphors and then yours.
Yeah, that was one, you know, that was one of those moments when I was adding that kind of other layer. And I was like, is this too meta if I talk about like a workshop I was in that helped me realize what I wanted to write in this book that I'm writing? Like, is that too, you know, it's like maybe too much, but it really was so, it's like such a key moment in me mm-hmm. making those connections. Mm-hmm. And I read Lydia Yukimich's memoir, The Chronology of Water, and I just loved it so much, and it like, blew my mind that I immediately started Googling her to see if she taught workshops, and learned that she actually has this great writing center in Portland called Corporeal Writing. So I flew there to take this workshop, and she was talking about this kind of theory she has, I guess, about, sorry about that siren in the background, calling in from New York City. yeah, just that, you know, that writers have these core metaphors that we can return to. And she was talking about it in terms of, you know, writers feeling like they have already told their stories, you know, and feeling like they've run out of new things to say. And she was saying, you know, these central experiences and central metaphors of your life, you can come back to forever and ever and ever and keep mining them for new material. And then we, you know, and then she gives a prompt to write our own metaphors. And I kind of was stuck, and the, you know, the metaphors that I could think of in the terms that she had been using were all imagery of my father's work. And I was kind of having this little existential crisis sitting there in this writing workshop, like, do I not have any of my own metaphors? Am I only using my father's? Have I like let his work totally take over my creative life?
Meanwhile, everyone is out there scribbling their own.
I was just like, oh my God, like, yeah, freaking out, having this like panic moment about my identity as a creative person, and then realized while sitting there that like, no, that's actually kind of the point, is that, you know, is that I've now spent enough time with his metaphors that they're now mine also, and I am allowed to engage with them and bring them further on my own, which unlocked a lot, because I had been afraid to assign meaning to any of his work externally. You know, I didn't want to speak for him. I didn't want to say that something meant something unless I had him writing in a notebook that it means this, you know, and but that kind of finally gave me permission to do some interpreting of my own and add my own layer to his work while talking about it, rather than only, you know, viewing it as a lens.
Mm-hmm. This is amazing. I love that moment. I'd love to give you a second to talk about Memoir Monday, if you don't mind, and that we really love collaborations here at Wednesday Literary. We talk about them all the time, and it seems that writers always have communities that they're involved in, and so we love to hear about those like exchanges. Yeah, could you talk about that with, I guess, Catapult, and you've got Narratively and Granta, who am I missing?
Guernica and The Rumpus and Literary. Oh.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Six partner publications. Yeah, so it started out as a newsletter, and I started it when I was the memoir editor at Narratively. We had been talking about starting a new newsletter for just the memoir section. And I was thinking, you know, I wouldn't subscribe to that personally, just because there are so many newsletters. I don't want multiple newsletters from individual publications. It's just too much, you know? So mm-hmm. I was thinking, what would make me want to subscribe to that newsletter? And decided to kind of go bigger and try and make it like a destination for memoir writing online in general, rather than just at one publication. And so I reached out to editors at, you know, places that publish personal essays that I love the most often, you know, and just asked like if they would want to collaborate on this newsletter and send me pieces every week to include. And I didn't know what the reception was going to be, but everybody was excited about it. It's like, yeah, sure, that sounds great. It's like, all you have to do is share the link on social media you know, and it'll get more eyeballs on your stuff. And then it kind of evolved, and I was like, what if it was a reading series too? And it was another thing where I was like, I don't know if people are going to be into that, but then people were. And so now it's a newsletter and a reading series, and it's been really great. It's kind of just like my excuse to reach out to memoirists that I like and invite them to read and get to talk to them. And yeah, it's been really fun.
It sounds kind of like our podcast.
Yeah. It does.
That's really great.
Has it changed since last year that much? How has it changed?
Yeah, I mean, it's been all over Zoom since, you know, for the pandemic, which at first I was unsure about. You know, usually the readings are at Powerhouse Arena in Brooklyn, and it's really nice to actually have some FaceTime. You know, that was part of the impetus for it originally, was that we all are behind our screens all the time, and wouldn't it be nice to go hang out in person and drink some like cheap wine out of plastic cups and, you know, do that whole thing. So, you know, the Zoom version is different, but it's also been cool because it means that I'm no longer restricted to writers who live in New York or are passing through. You know, there's no funding of any kind for it, so I'm not in a position to like pay for people to fly to New York and stay in a hotel. That would all be coming out of my pocket, and that's not something I can afford. So being able to have writers come from everywhere and being able to have, you know, people tune in to listen from everywhere has been really cool. So yeah, it's working fine. I'm still looking forward to when we can go back to doing it in person, or at least maybe some in person and some Zoom. I don't really know how that's going to work, but
Yeah, I think we're all ready.
Yeah.
Some governors more than others.
Yeah.
Anyway, what's next for you, Lily? What's on the docket?
Well, I have a bunch of stuff planned for the next couple months. You know, I'm in full like book promo mode, trying not to, you know, annoy the hell out of myself and everybody who knows me by just like being on social media constantly promoting stuff. But that's, you know, that's the game. You just have to bite the bullet and do it. And I also am working on a book proposal that I'm hoping to send out later this year, so we'll see.
Yeah,
gotta keep it moving, you know.
Yeah,
but like having something else to generate is helping me kind of balance out the feeling like the publicity aspect has taken over my life. You know, get to still feel like I'm creating something and not just becoming a like salesperson Parker. Talking my wares on the corner. Yeah.
What has been kind of giving you hope this last year, just to close things up? That's a short list, Lily.
Well, no,
she's not a hopeful person. She's a writer. You know, there's...
Yeah, I think it's less, you know, not particularly hopeful. I'm more just like, I know this has to end eventually, and I just am surviving it in the meantime. And I'm very good at compartmentalizing and, you know, working through upheaval, and I've done it in my life before and I'm doing it now, and I've managed to just still be working and writing and talking to my friends and cooking food and watching good TV and just waiting until I can see people in person again.
It's a good list.
That is good. Yeah. Well, it was really great to get to meet you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
And your book. Thank you.
All right.
Bye. Thank you, Lily. Bye-bye.
This has been a live recording of the Effing Shakespeare podcast by Bloomsday Literary at the 2021 AWP Conference and Book Fair. Effing Shakespeare is a production of Bloomsday Literary in association with Houston Creative Space, hosted by Kate Martin Williams and Jessica Cole, and produced by me, Fu Lu. Our trusty and hardworking intern is Sanviti Sedan. Please subscribe, rate, and review wherever podcasts are found.